Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Underrated Movie Podcast, a podcast where we discuss films that are underrated, underappreciated, and the ones that have just slipped under the radar and passed most people by. I am your host, Derek McDuff, and today we're going to be talking about the 2016 film written and directed by John Carney, Thing Street. Today, joining me, I have a prestigious guest, Alex Marcus, the director of podcasting over at The Pop Break. He does a bunch of podcast stuff over there, including a show that he's been kind enough to let me on, Bill versus the MCU. Thank you so much for coming on today, Alex. Before we get going here, what can you tell the people about you and The Pop Break?
Yeah, so thanks so much for having me on. I'm very excited to be here talking about this movie that we're about to talk about. Over on The Pop Break, you might be confused that I am the host of Bill versus the MCU, because as I say at the start of every episode, I am not Bill. My co-host is Bill Bodkin, who is the editor-in-chief of thepopbreak.com. Popbreak.com has been around for 15 years, almost. It's a great kind of pop culture website. We've got cool interviews and reviews and podcasts and photos from all around your pop culture interests, from music to movies to TV and even some wrestling. So it's a really fun site. I'm excited to be a part of it. I've been a part of it now for almost 5 years, which is crazy to think about. And I run the podcasts over there. So we've got a ton of podcasts. I host Bill versus the MCU, as I said, which is a Marvel rewatch podcast. We started it in 2022, where we watched the first four phases of the MCU all in 1 year in a monthly installments. We moved on in 2023 to covering the Marvel adjacent stuff, including the Defenders saga over from Netflix and also Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. from ABC. And now we're doing something really exciting, which is we're going through all of the Fox X-Men movies as we get ready for Deadpool 3, which we now know is being called Deadpool and Wolverine, which is very exciting. So that's the main gig that I have over there. We also have a monthly show called TV Break, where we talk about the ins and outs of the world of TV. And I also sometimes co-host of the Batman by the Numbers podcast, which is a fun monthly Batman-centric podcast that you can listen to, hosted by Dan Cohen. So I've got a lot of stuff over there. But if you like movies, if you like music, if you like comic book stuff, if you like TV stuff, we've got so much stuff, reality shows. We've got a great Bachelor podcast called Roses and Rejections that has a nice following over there. So definitely just go on over to thepopbreak.com, check out all that stuff. It's really good.
Yeah, it's great stuff. I've been lucky enough to be on a guest on a couple shows on that podcast feed, and have had a great time every time. But yeah, like you said, you cover a lot of things, including two things which are very relevant to what we're going to be talking about today, which is, of course, movies and then music, because this is a musical film. Not a musical, but a film with a lot of original music in it. Yes. And like talked about one other John Carney film on this show way in the past, Begin Again, and they kind of form almost like a spiritual trilogy. I guess there's four of them now with Flora and Son, but he had his big breakout with Once, and then followed that up with Begin Again, like I mentioned, and then Sing Street. So this would be kind of the third of that spiritual trilogy, obviously following a group of young, like, high schoolers in Dublin in the 1980s. But, you know, I sent you a big list of movies that I was interested in covering, and you chose this one, and I was so excited that you did, because of all the, you know, this one, it's pretty, you know, it's well-received, but it's kind of, I would say, fallen into the under-the-radar category, even more so than something like Once. So what about this one was drew you to it that you wanted to cover it here on Underrated?
Well, so going through the list that you gave me, there were a number of movies that popped out right away where it's like, oh, that's a movie I would like to talk about. That's a good movie that I'd like to talk about. But when I got to Sing Street, I was like, oh, this is absolutely the answer. Because number one, I would love an opportunity to rewatch this movie and have an excuse to do so. So I'm very happy that you gave me that. Thank you very much. But also, I think it's such an underrated movie because it's one of the few movies that we have today, in my opinion, where you truly could recommend it to anyone. I don't think that there's a single person on the planet who, if you said, watch Sing Street, they would walk away having a bad time. Now, they might not like it as much as I did or as much as you did, but they're gonna like it at least a little bit because it has the perfect balance of heart and humor, and it has this great kind of artistic quality to it in the sense of crafting music and crafting songs and like the spark of originality and creativity, but it also just captures that like discontentment of youth, but with a somewhat optimistic bent to it. There's a little bit of a fantasy wish fulfillment part of it. So I just feel like there's so many different things that people can latch onto. All of the characters that we get as main characters are really well fleshed out. Even, you know, we have the love interest that could, in a lot of coming of age movies, be kind of one dimensional, be ciphers. And I feel like we get a really good opportunity to flesh out the love interest here and make her feel like a full, rich character on her own right. So I just think there's so much stuff here that people would love if they gave it a chance. And I just feel like not enough people in 2016 gave it a chance. Not enough people knew about it. Not enough people watched it. It was well received. But I think at the time, a lot of critics said, well, this is John Carney doing the thing that we know John Carney can do. And that kind of makes it a little less interesting, I think, especially for film critics who, you know, they watch a million things and they're just like, yeah, okay, he's doing that thing again that he does. That's cool, you know. But I think personally, this is his best film. I think it really is a culmination of that trilogy that you were talking about. And I think in terms of the wider public, it just didn't get a huge distribution. You know, it was in theaters. It wasn't a tiny indie release, but it wasn't on 2,000 screens. And it didn't get a lot of Oscar attention. I think a lot of people thought it would get an original song nomination. It really deserved it, in my opinion, and it just didn't happen for it. So I think that there was a lot of places where it could have gotten that bump in front of more people, and it just never crossed over for in that way. And I don't know why, because I feel like, you know, a movie like Coda comes around a few years later, and it's a very similar sort of coming-of-age story about the passion of music and dysfunctional families, and it just, like, and it wins Best Picture at the Oscars, and everybody's like, what? Where did that come from? And
even I'm just like, starring one of the same guys in it.
Exactly. And it's just like, where were you guys a few years ago? Because, man, like, Coda's a sweet movie, but this movie is phenomenal. And so, yeah, that's why I picked it, because I just think it's a movie that you could truly recommend to anybody, and there's going to be something in there that people are going to like.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything that you're saying. You know, it's one that, like I said, like, Once got a lot of, it was his first kind of big thing, and, you know, it got recognition, it got about the same critical praise, and, well, you know, all of his movies have just been decent performers, but, like you said, it got snubbed at the Oscars, it got a Golden Globe nomination, but who gives a shit about that, honestly, you know? And, you know, it didn't get any Oscar nobs, but even in songs, God, there's so many just banger songs in this. But, you know, with that all said, what about the content of the movie? Do you love, so, like, what do you think about, like, the actual plot, the story, the characters, all of that?
So there's so many things about the story of this film that I think work really well, but I think it all goes back to the fact that this really feels like it's about a group of teenagers who are just trying to figure out their place in the world. Like, I love that John Carney really cast teenagers in this movie. It's not a bunch of 25-year-olds playing 16. Like, it's, you really feel like you're watching a bunch of kids, like, figuring out who they want to be for the first time. And I love, like, there's this whole, like, basically, if you haven't watched the movie and you're listening to this, the basic plot is that we get this group of kids, our main character, he gets has to go to a school, a new school, because his family is kind of on tough times financially. So he has to go to a new school. He doesn't know anybody there, but he meets this girl outside of the school who he wants to impress. And so he kind of invites her to be in his band's music video, even though he doesn't have a band and they're not doing a music video. And so from there, he's like, okay, well, I got to meet somebody to help me make a band. And once I can put the band together, I have to figure out what music are we going to play. And he's got this older brother who is this kind of like sage source of musical wisdom for him, and from there it just kind of goes where this kid and his friends, they try on all of these different styles of music, and they take on all the personality attached to those different styles of music as they're trying to find out who they are in all of this. And it's such a, I think that's such a common experience that we have in high school, where we're really trying to say like, well, who do I want to be, and how can culture shape me into the person I want to be. I feel like anybody who is making a podcast or probably listening to a podcast about movies has had that experience and that relationship to culture. And so I think that this movie gets that so right, and it's so wonderful. And I also think another highlight is just watching the kids make the music, like watching that spark of creativity of the main character and his friend who writes the music for him. He writes the lyrics, them kind of figuring it out on the fly. Like, there's a certain magic in that that this movie captures. And I think that's really hard to do, because we've seen that in music documentaries forever, and it's always so exciting. Like, there was that Beatles documentary that came out a couple years ago where you're watching them just in the room just come up with like songs that will be these like titanic pop culture phenomenons for decades to come. And they're just like in a room and they're just like, oh, what if we do this with this? And then boom, it happens. And you're like, oh my God, magic, right? But in movies, that can oftentimes be really contrived, because it is, they already know the end point, right? So they have to kind of like make it feel organic. They already know what the song is going to be when they're making the scene of them trying to figure out the song, right? So it can sometimes feel a little bit forced, a little bit inorganic, like I said. And here it just feels so organic. It feels so true. And you see the excitement in their faces, and you see the way they're kind of vibing with each other, and you see how it's making their friendship deeper and their bond to the music deeper and their bond to this project deeper. It all is like on these layers, and it's just wonderful. I love it so much. I could just keep ranting, but what do you like about this movie?
No, I think, yeah, all very well put. And I do think that, you know, I love all three of the John Carney movies. I need to see Flora and Son. I've heard mixed things about that. I was going to try and watch it if I had time before this. I didn't have time, unfortunately. But I think you really hit on something with the whole creative process of songwriting. And that's one thing that I've loved about all three of these movies, is that, like you said, if you are someone like me, or like a writer, or like a listener of a pod, like people who are creative people, I think that creative process that exists in all of his films about these people who are songwriters and trying to make it in some way or another really will resonate with you. And it has always resonated with me in all of these films. And you brought up the whole thing about seeing them develop these songs and the process of them coming up with this. And like, he's like, what does this idea mean? What is this? His bandmates asking him, what does this mean? And that's so unlike a lot of other musical movies that you would see. And it's something, ironically, last week we talked about another very musical film, the last episode, which was Walk Hard. And one thing I talked about that movie does that kind of lampoons the thing in so many of these movies, you know, you'll have like Bob Marley say, don't worry about a thing. And then like, it just cuts to him like playing that song or whatever in the next scene. It's just like, you know, where they have to tell the whole life of this, you know, those music biopics. But this,
yeah, and I have not seen that Bob Marley movie that is out right now, but I have heard that it is extremely guilty of that, like in a way that is really rough to get through.
Yeah, and I haven't either. That's just based on the trailer, but like just based on like all these music biopics and all the marketing for this, I'm like, it's just like a thing. And I love that all these movies really are just about the creative process. And I've loved all of them for that. But what I think this one stands apart from those movies, because, you know, there's a lot of similarities. Both this and Once are about somebody in Dublin wanting to make it big and go over to London by like with this song, with this person they may or may not be in love with. But what this one does is it really captures the kind of doing that in your youth, not doing it in your 30s or something like that, but doing, or your late 20s or whatever, but doing it like really it so authentically in a way that I've very rarely seen captures what it feels like to be just a kid and to how weird it is and how like just high school is absolute chaos. You're trying on different personalities and you're trying to just see who you are and what fits and you're not really sure of anything yet, and you develop these really intense friendships really quickly. There's very few things that I think really, because there's a million shows about like kids and, you know, or movies about kids and stuff like that, but they're always a little bit contrived. They always feel a little bit like inauthentic. Regardless of quality, I think the only thing that I kept thinking of that this really reminded me of was Freaks and Geeks. So hard, I was like, wow, this feels like the same way that Judd Apatow and Paul Feig were like, here's me in the mid-80s, and it's obviously very inspired by their like awkward experiences and growing pains and the friends they made and how they wanted to be creative people. And this feels just like, I mean, John Carney, actually, I didn't even know Sing Street was an actual school. But it was, and he went there. And when I found out, I was like, it blew my mind. I thought it was like, this is just some invention for this movie. But yeah, he lived in Dublin. He went to Sing Street. And even, you know, I won't spoil what happens at the end of Freaks and Geeks, especially since it kind of got canceled. But the way that ends really reminded me of the way this ends, where it's like they are going off. And you don't know what's going to happen with them. It's a hopeful ending. It's a happy, sad ending, which works so well with the themes of this movie. It's like, yeah. There's a moment even when the end where you're like, are they going to die on the ocean right now? But it's like, nope, they can go on the wake of the ferry. What's going to happen with them when they get to London? They don't have any plans. Who knows with that? I love the kind of just beautiful ending that you only get from a movie or a show getting abruptly canceled. Maybe the only other thing that I could think of that really portrays kids as accurately is maybe Superbad. That's a film that I always go to bat for. But yeah, I really loved it. And one other thing too that I'll just throw in is I love the relationship between him and the older brother character played by Jack Raynor. And I think he is fantastic in this movie. And his whole thing about him being an older brother and that speech he gives about like, he's like, I was the one cutting through the jungle with a machete. And you're able to walk this path and to kind of like live your dream because of what I did. And me, you know, being an older brother, I resonated so much with his character. And it's something that I kind of like, you know, it's like, yeah, like when you are the older brother and you deal with your parents when they're younger and they're crazier and you kind of have to like wear them down a little bit so that your younger siblings can get through this and can like start living their dreams. And, you know, you might not be the first one to go live your dreams because I love that he's kind of like filled with regret that he didn't do this. Like he didn't get in a boat and take off, but he's still so happy for his little brother. And I'm like, you know, I'm watching this movie. I'm getting kind of emotional at the end. And it, you know, cause it seems like, oh, it's really a story about him and the girlfriend and that, but Raynor comes back in every once in a while. And then that last like little text in the movie for Brothers Everywhere, I started fucking bawling. I was like, oh my God, like that really, really hit me. So I don't know if you have like siblings or anything like that, but that really pinpoint like knew where to hit me in my emotional funny bone.
Yeah, I'm a youngest sibling, so I definitely don't have the older sibling experience, but obviously as a younger sibling I have an older sibling, so I could see it working so well. What I love about that character and what I think makes this movie so special compared to a lot of other movies that have similar structures, similar coming of age situations, is that the movie lets you see Jack Raynor's character, who through the eyes of his little brother, through Connor's eyes, as this titanic, larger than life figure who is an expert on he knows everything that Connor would ever want to know. He has the perfect music recommendation for every conversation. He can go off the top of his head and give what Connor sees as this like incredible wisdom and knowledge about all of the different bands and all the different artists, and also is so observant about his family in a way that Connor isn't quite yet and can know his mom and his dad so intimately and help him and help Connor understand what is happening in his own house, right? So he is this sage voice of wisdom. And yet the movie lingers on him, and the performance of Jack Rayner is so special because it lets you see how, like, outside of Connor's perspective, Jack Rayner's character is incredibly sad. He's depressed. He has nothing seemingly in his life outside of this relationship with his brother that he values so deeply. He has dropped out of school, right? He had a dream that he has clearly let go. His family is falling apart, and he is old. He's an adult. He's old enough to know what is happening in a way that his younger siblings don't quite get until the end of the film. He knows what's happening from the start in a way that's really deeply upsetting, in a way that he's not willing to engage with, but he is clearly experiencing. So his life is sad, it's empty, it's lonely, and it's so interesting that you can have a character be both this source of incredible inspiration and aspiration for Connor, and yet also for the audience to see him and see how much he's struggling and how unhappy he is and how he is just putting all of that energy into his younger brother, because he's looking at his younger brother as the person who can go out and do the thing that he never could. And there's so much love and so much warmth in that, but there's so much tragedy in that too. It's heartbreaking that's because you look, I mean, you know, I'm in my 30s now and I'm looking at him and I'm like, you can't be older than like, what, 21, 22 years old, right? And you think your life is over. You think that your dreams are dead and your whole life is behind you. And so you need to prop this kid up and let him have the life you always wanted. It's like, man, you have so much left to give and you don't see that. And that's so sad. So it's like this movie is capable of, I think that is just what's so great about this movie in a microcosm, because it is just, it's so sweet and so loving and so full of energy and enthusiasm and creativity, and also so sad and bleak and harsh about the reality of it all at once. And that's really hard to pull off effectively. And I think it's a testament to the writing, and it's a testament to Jack Rayner as a performer that they nail it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, incredible for performance. And, you know, I just want to say, like, you know, speaking of him, and I love the visual metaphor. Like, we already talked about, like, them following the wake of the fairy, but I think that is such a great visual metaphor to end the film on. It's like, yeah, they are caught in this storm, and the only thing that allows them to get through it is they are following in the wake of this boat that's going in front of them, just like he's able to do all this stuff because he's following in the wake of his older brother. I think that's just, like, that's just such great screenwriting and just like an amazing visual metaphor. And so I love all of that. I love his whole, and you know, you brought up how it does feel very happy and sad. And if I've said it once on the show, I've said it a million times. I fucking bittersweet movies are my absolute favorite. And because that's how life is, you know, life is just a combination of sadness and joy. And you know, like, when he's at this moment when he's like finally like kissed this girl that he's had a thing for forever, and like everything seems like it's turning around, his home life is kind of falling apart at the same time, and his parents are getting a divorce, and you know, he, as his band is finally hitting its stride, things are going wrong. And I just love that, like, he thinks he's like yeah, I've got these problems, but then he looks at like his girlfriend, or he looks at his bully, and it's like, oh, like, things are always going to, like, be different. And the perspectives that it gives you, I think, on all of that are really, really smartly done. And I would totally agree that, yeah, this is Carney's best movie. His other stuff, obviously great, but this is something above any of that.
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, it's just, we get so many coming-of-age stories, and it's just a full genre of film at this point. There's so many. Even in the year of 2016, there are several really strong coming-of-age stories that came out alongside this one. And it's just, it's real. I really think this is just like a perfect coming-of-age story, and because it does all of the things that you need it to do without ever feeling dishonest, without ever feeling like you're conforming to the contours of a screenplay, right? You're conforming to the audience's expectation. You're setting things up so you can knock them down. It doesn't feel that way. It feels really honest about who these kids are and who this guy is and what his life is like. And, you know, it's an autobiographical film. And sometimes that can lend an authenticity to a film that you don't get otherwise. But sometimes it can also be like a lot of pitfalls in that, too, because it's hard for an auteur filmmaker like Carney to necessarily know what is it about my personal story that is going to resonate with everyone. You know, sometimes it can be hard to decipher that. Sometimes our greatest filmmakers' most personal films are the most alienating to their audience, you know, and this is not that. This is somehow so authentic and so honest and so deeply relatable in a way that just, it just works. It just works so well. And we haven't talked that much about the music yet, but I think it's also really important to say that these songs are both great and feel mostly like they could be written by a really talented 15-year-old, you know?
Like Yeah.
And I think that's important, right? Like, it would have been very easy to make it just feel like, oh, well, this is just like professional music and he's just a wunderkind and whatever. But it's like, no, like, they are simple, but there's something special about them. And they hit the emotion that they need to, but they still feel like they are the work of a kid who's trying to figure things out and trying to, like, respond to his influences and put together lyrics and melodies and things like that. And he's very talented, but it does still feel like the work of a kid. And I think that that adds to that authenticity in a way that is really important.
Yeah, totally. It's got that, like, youthful feel, which is, like, it's crazy that, like, Carney did this when he was in, like, either his late 30s or early 40s, because it feels so true to what a kid would go through, what a teenager would be feeling. And that's why I feel like so many of these movies, even the good ones that are focused on kids, do feel like that level of removal. Even a good one like Booksmart, it's kind of ridiculous and over the top and stuff like that. Whereas this is like, you know, like that's, it really takes you back to how you felt at that age, and the songwriting absolutely goes along with that. The songs rip, but like, yeah, they do have that kind of like rawness where they feel like this is, yeah, these are some of the first things that they've written. Like, even Jack Rayner says, like, yeah, he's like, yeah, it's a really good first draft. Like, this is promising, you know?
Yeah.
You mentioned, too, the not conforming thing, which I think is a big theme in this movie, right? The whole punk rock of it all, which is something else that, like, I think of in Freaks and Geeks, how they were just like, you know, fuck it. Like, that's why they got canceled, because they were just not willing to give into the studio demands and stuff like that. And this feels like, yeah, he is this kid who's stuck in this system. He's, you know, getting bullied by these bullies, getting bullied by the brothers at the school. And he's trying his best to be an individual, to stand out. He can't even have the color of his shoes he wants. But, you know, as his brother tells him, like, rock and roll is about risks. You know, like, you've got to be afraid to get hurt, to fail. And that rock and roll attitude, that punk rock, just like, fuck you attitude, is throughout this movie. And, you know, I love that moment when he, like, kind of, like, takes that chance and he's like, you know, you see, is it Josefina? I want to, like, keep calling her the girlfriend, but Rafina.
Rafina.
And how she takes that chance and, you know, just jump, even though she can't swim, she jumps off, you know, into the water. And then he takes the chance and, you know, goes in for the kiss. And then he kind of ruins it afterwards, like all kids would. Like, she's just like, yeah, you ruined it, you know, because it's just like, he's like so excited. He's like, what about this? And it's just, it feels so authentic and just punk rock and in your face and just really, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And he's a kid who, he's had these issues, but he's never dealt with the things that she's dealt with, and he's trying to relate to her. So I think all of that is just fucking fantastic.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing about it being a really good coming-of-age story, right? Like, a huge part of coming-of-age stories is your protagonist is starting to realize what is unique and wonderful and terrible about their life, and then at some point they become a little bit self-obsessed by that realization, because it's so new and so powerful for them, and they're forced to then see the wider world in some way and have their kind of self-absorbed teenager perspective punctured, and you get to see, okay, well, actually, like this incredible realization that I'm having, like, also everyone else has it, and it's also, and there's also there's so much more than just what I'm feeling. And I think this movie handles it really well because it doesn't force a really strong contrast. It just lets Connor exist in the world, and so Connor is dealing with his family stuff, and then he is coming in contact with other people who are dealing with other types of family stuff. And yeah, Rafina's life is on paper much worse than his, right? Mm-hmm. But they're both going through something difficult, and that shared sadness is connecting them. And he slowly starts to realize, I think, a little bit about her situation in that same sort of way of like puncturing his bubble. But it's funny because in the movie, it gives him that opportunity to say, like, oh, wow, you know, I thought my life was hard, but then it turns out your life is, like, so much worse than mine. And I think a lot of movies play that as, like, a really profound realization. And instead, we get to be in Rafina's perspective for a second and see, like, oh, that is actually kind of a shitty thing to say to somebody.
Yeah.
And she, like, kind of takes offense to it, but not in a way where it's like, oh, no, now they're broken up and we need this, you know, contrived fight or whatever. It's just kind of like, it just feels honest. It just feels really honest in a way that I really, really respect.
Yeah. And then, you know, on the flip side of that too, you have him encountering the songwriter, the guy who's like at the start, at least, the most musically talented of any of them, who knows, he's like, can play every instrument and stuff like that. And it seems like his, you know, home life is just kind of like boring. Like, he's just like him and his mom, and his mom's like,
it's,
yeah,
rabbits and music, that's pretty much his whole life.
Yeah. And his mom's like, yeah, like, make some friends and stuff like there. So you get to see like all the different aspects, and I love the little bits of honesty you get with everyone. You know, I think it's this little, there's like these little blink and you'll miss the moments, but like they're all playing in the other room and she's like, okay, cool, and she just like slams the door and brings out the vibrator and just like, I just the moments of honesty like that, the like little glimpses to be like, yeah, these are all characters with their own internal lives, and that's like all you really get from her, because most of the time she is just like kind of like being like, hey guys, here's a go and here's some snacks for you, whatever, whatever. But she clearly has her own life and desires and stuff like that, and that little snippet is just to remind you that like she's not here to just like serve these guys. She has her own thing going on, and I love that.
Yeah, every person feels like a person, even if you're some of the characters you're really only getting glimpses of. Like, I mean, Connor's sister, played by Kelly Thornton, character's name is Anne. You don't really get a lot from her in terms of what her deal is. She gets to respond to her brother and call him out on his bullshit a couple of times. A great line is like, don't use, you know, I don't do words. But you know, overall, like, so there are characters that don't get fully fleshed out, but I feel like every character, there's a specificity to the way they're being presented where it feels like you're understanding who they are in a small but meaningful way. And I think that just goes towards the fact this is a very lean film. It really just, it maximizes every minute of screen time to move forward Connor's progression as a character, and to move forward this dream of going from, I'm this guy who's completely alone in a family that's imploding underneath me and I don't know where I fit in the world, to I now have the self-confidence to run away with the girl that I love on a boat, stealing my mom's money and hoping for the best in London, right? Like, that's where the movie ends, right? So that's, I think, like, every single moment is moving us closer towards that goal. And there's really no extraneous beats. And yet we get so much detail and so much reality and so much just like on the corners specificity of this place and these people. And that's a really hard balance. And I think that they really nail it.
Yeah. And like to speak to your like the conciseness of the screenwriting and how good it is, I think that, you know, moment that I really appreciate is towards the end when they play the slow song at the dance. That's doing so many things, right? It's giving us a good song. And if you think of like some musicals that I don't really care for or something, they'll be like, cool, here's just a good song to just entertain you for 5 minutes and the story kind of stops or whatever. But the good ones are like, oh, here's like a song and it's going to keep informing you of like what all these characters are going through. It's going to move the plot forward, which this clearly does. Like, it's like, hey, this is showing you his emotional state, showing you how he's feeling about him dealing with this whole situation that he's been through with Ruffina. And then it's also showing, like, what is going on at the dance. It's setting up the tone. It's a really good song as well. And then it's also, since it's cutting away to her listening to the song, her crying and stuff like that, and it's cutting back and forth between those two scenes, you're understanding where both of them are at emotionally, and it builds up to this big finale. And if you don't have that scene that is showing you both where both of them are at, it doesn't work. And you could have like a song for him and a song for her, but instead they expedite it and gives you them, both of them, him playing it, her listening to it in completely different locations, but you never feel disjointed. You always feel like it's of a piece. And the fact that they were able to pull that off, along with so many other things in this movie, and seeing their relationship develop. I love that the first song is about kind of like meeting a new person. And like he even says, like, you know, it's about like when you meet someone, they could be anyone. And I love that, just like kids do, you know, you're trying to seem cool and like be like, yeah, I'm like this. And, you know, like we said, he makes this band just to like try to impress this girl that he knows nothing about. And she's right. Just like, yeah, I'm a model to like a model. She's and maybe I'll show up, you know, if I have time, whatever. They're both trying to seem so cool. And by the end, they have both bared their souls to each other. They both know so much about each other. She's really let him into like her personal life. He has too. And then so you see that relationship fully develop over the course of the film through all these ups and downs. And, you know, you're not sure if they're going to make it. And, you know, I love that her the other people living with her at the girls' home are like, I was rooting for you. Because we are too, you know, like that's our audience surrogate. We're like, yes, I'm rooting for you too. And to see that relationship, that dual character arc pay off so well in the end, it and to have that all tied into what's going on with the brother and the other bandmates and the themes of rebellion against this tyrannical school and this tyrannical brother, it all is just such concise screening. And the fact they're able to do all that in an hour 40. Just get in, get out, do it all. And to have a killer soundtrack all throughout that, to have like, I don't know, 6 or 7 like incredible songs. The fact that they pulled that off is pretty special, I think.
Yeah, I fully agree. I want to ask you a question, though, because we're praising the originality, we're praising the authenticity of this movie, and rightfully so. But they do one truly cliched screenwriter move, which is force a sort of separation between our love couple to amp up the stakes of the climax, right? So that we get this moment late in the film where Ruffina asks Connor, like, oh, when is the next music video going to be? And he's like, oh, it's going to be next week. And she's like, oh, okay. And like, we linger on her face. And we realize, oh, she has plans for next week. She's not going to be there. That's going to be a problem. And then we find out, oh, she runs away with the other guy who had been out of the picture for a while. All of this happens off screen. We're with Connor. He's surprised. He's confused. He's hurt. He doesn't know why this is happening. And then it all builds eventually to this moment where he runs into her and just turns out she's not in London like anymore because she got into a fight with her boyfriend, but the boyfriend hit her and she left him. And so now she's feeling bad about herself. And then she's rude to Connor unexpectedly, accidentally as a result. And then so now Connor doesn't want to be with her anymore. And then finally they all come together in the end and they have this like great moment of like, you know, as you described. But that is sort of like a textbook way to create a little bit of extra tension and juice the climax that can feel really contrived. Did it work for you here? Did it feel contrived or do you feel like they earned it?
So I think that's for me, that's why it's like a 4.5-star movie instead of like a perfect 5-star movie. Because, yeah, it does kind of feel a little bit contrived, especially when, you know, she's like, oh, tell me about that. And he's like, no, I don't think I will, you know, because he's upset at her. And then they have to kind of have that big comeback thing because he's like, yeah, you chose this other guy over me. You're only being with me because he like left you high and dry. So you're just like when she has that moment, she's like, I'm just like my mother. I'm going to like basically she says I'm settling for you more or less. And he, you know, obviously is kind of offended by that. So it that, you know, story beat is a little like you said, it's a little cliched. But the way they pull it off, I think, was they did a really good job of it. It doesn't completely take me out of it because I think that they thematically tied into a lot of the stuff that's going through. I think that her talking about like you know, kind of like settling and wanting to go to McDonald's kind of ties her into the brother character quite a bit and kind of draws some parallels between them and feeling like, yeah, like they're these people who are a little bit older than him, have been through a little bit more, have seen a little bit more, and are kind of maybe like realizing like this is all it has. But so it is a little bit contrived, but I think that they did a good job with it. I think that they do manage to, it's a little bit shaky, but they manage to land the plane.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that they get bonus points for me because they play everything in a way that doesn't feel too melodramatic. It really, everything is in the same pitch as the rest of the film, to borrow a musical phrase, because it really is like, we don't get a big blow up fight scene between the two of them. And they're like, you left, how could you? You know, like none of that is happening. It's just she makes an offhanded remark where she, in a way that is both unthinking and accidental, but also betrays some truth about how she's thinking about him and this experience. But it's really about how she's thinking about herself. But he's a 15-year-old boy and doesn't have the emotional intelligence to understand that that wasn't meant to be directed at him. But he's just hearing it like that. And so he takes it personally. And then he just leaves politely. You know, he doesn't get into that big fight. They don't reunite in like a rain soaked, you know, shouting match, or then they kiss and declare their love for each other. So they avoid a lot of cliche inside of what is ultimately a screenwriting crutch. So I do think that they do the best they can to make it still feel like part of the whole that we've been dealing with up until that point. But I do kind of, I would love to see what the film could be like without that bit of it. Mm-hmm. And if we could have gotten the tension and the climax that we got without needing to pull them apart. But, you know, maybe it is an honest thing about this character of Ruffina specifically, that she would not be, that there would be some indecisiveness and fear to commit herself so deeply to Connor and his dream. And she needed a moment of kind of like running away to find her way back. So just because it's a cliche and a screenwriting crutch doesn't mean that there isn't truth and emotional honesty to it. And I think that, you know, Lucy Boynton, who plays Ruffina, does an excellent job making her not be a manic pixie dream girl, you know, letting her be a real person. And I think that that also goes a long way to making the end of the film work better than it otherwise could have.
Yeah, absolutely. Because like tropes are tropes for a reason. You know, there's a reason why these screenwriting cliches have existed for so long, because they work, and a lot of times they are true to life. And one thing I love that this movie does with that is that it does first give you that kind of like the movie ending, you know, the like the fake resolution where she like comes in at the end, and it's very over the top, where like, and then his brother shows up and he punches the priest, and like it's the one time in the movie where it intentionally kind of breaks from the reality. Because it's not like a Walter Mitty thing where he's like imagining all these things all the time. It's the only time that the movie does it, and I think it's very smartly utilized to be like, yeah, they had this fight, they had this blow up, and like, this is how you would like expect the movie to resolve. And it's not like it's like a shock that we like know, you know, we know that this is all in his imagination. But, you know, it still does its job. Like, it's first of all, just a great scene, a great song, once again. But it gives you the mindset that he's in. He's probably watched a lot of movies. He expects to have this big movie ending. And when you get the actual movie ending, it feels a lot more earned, a lot better, because it's kind of juxtaposed with the kind of fake reality that he saw, where the brother shows up, where all these things happen, where she bursts in and everything. It feels a lot more true and real in that end, and I'm glad that we got to see both.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think that the use of that fantasy sequence, it is deployed at exactly the right time. Because I think some movies would have had every music video be a fantasy sequence, and that would have kind of robbed us of what is so sweet and earnest about what they're actually doing, right? A different kind of movie would make the first one be a fantasy sequence, so we have an understanding of what is going on in his head. And I think that would have been wrong, too, because then it would have failed to live up to, like, all of the things that they actually did would fail to live up to his imagination. And that's not really the point. The point, as he says, like, my brother told me to dream big because one day, you know, it'll be big. And the point is, like, all of these experiences are building to the eventuality of hopefully being able to do it like the pros do. So we don't need to undercut that by using fantasy. I think a lot of movies, like you said, would have built to the final sequence being the fantasy sequence, where it's like, finally, now we get to see what it's like. But that would have really done a disservice to what's so wonderful about that last performance, where you get to see them playing all those songs and the kids really liking the music and them growing. You see them growing on stage together in over the course of that set that they're performing. And you feel like, okay, there's something here that they could actually have. There's some specialness to this. And so I feel like robbing the reality of that sequence by making it be fantasy would really undercut a lot of the culmination of the arc for all those characters. But using it in the moment that they did allows you to set the emotional scene for what comes later without undercutting what came before. It's a very bold choice to use it the way they did. And I think that it's, as you said, it's just expertly done, expertly executed, and it really pays off.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, of all the great songs in this movie, the song that plays in that scene, Drive It Like You Stole It, I think is probably...
Oh, I love that song.
Oh my gosh. It's,
I listen
say
to
it's
it all
favorite.
The time still. I still listen to it all the time.
Yeah,
I have a playlist for the songs of 2016 in film, because it was such a great musical year in film, and it's the year of La La Land, right? Everybody knows that. But there's so many great moments of music in film from that year in particular, and this is Drive It Like You Stole It is in that ultimate top five category.
Very
on that
nice.
Playlist.
Very nice. Yeah, because I always whenever I have a film that has a big musical influence or has a big musical moment, I actually, so if anybody wants to check it out, I have a playlist on Spotify for this, and I was debating which one I wanted to put on, and I've randomly been covering a lot of very musical inspired movies, not just this month, but the past year or so, and so I was debating which one to put. I think I'm gonna put Drive It Like You Stole It on the playlist for this movie. Would you say that's your favorite, or do you have what's your favorite one?
I think that's my favorite because it captures the youthful exuberance so well. It gets that sense of I'm going to just the world is so simple. All I have to do is run away, which is no adult in the world thinks that that's the solution to anything. But when you're 16, that makes perfect sense. And so it just it feels so true to that honest expression of teenage angst, while still being so aspirational and optimistic and fun. It's you guys don't understand me. I'm going to get out of this town and I'm going to succeed. And it's fun that I'm telling you this. And it just nails that so well. So that's definitely my favorite one. But there's the song that he writes for her that I'm forgetting the name of it now, but it's the one where it's 2 o'clock on the edge of the morning. You know that one? That one I think is a very beautiful love song that I do also like. That's a close second for me.
Yeah, and it feels like there is a pretty good variety. It's all 80s inspired stuff, but so there's some that are slow songs and some that are more reminiscent of Duran Duran, some of them that are more punk and some of them that are more pop. So I like that you get a pretty good variety of stuff in here, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. There is variety to it. And that's important because it's reflective of the experience of Connor and his friends, in the sense of every time that they make a new song, they're experiencing a different emotion, right? They're reflecting on something that they're seeing in the world, and they're also discovering new music and new influences, and they're letting you see how influence shapes who they are and what types of observations they're making about the world and how that filters into their music. So that variety is so key to the themes and characterizations in the film as well.
Yeah, and one thing I really like, because you talked about all of them kind of, working together on these these things. And one thing that I think this film does really well, that a lot of the, the music biopics, which I talked about last episode, don't do very well, is covers the real collaborative process of certain mediums, including both filmmaking and, of course, here, music. And it's he's writing the songs, but someone else is writing the music. And I love that they clearly get better. The beginning, he's just kind of a shitty singer, but he's really good at the end, and he learns to play the guitar at the end. But yeah, it's not just him. He brings in, he has all these different friends. They all learn to play instruments. Even by the end, pulling in his bully to just be the roadie. He has the manager. He has, of course, Ruffino, who is kind of his like muse, his ingenue, but she also brings helps them with like their style and their look and, you know, the way they're going to present themselves. So I love that. It feels like something that, you know, whether it be, unless you're like writing like a novel or something like that, so much of the creative like arts is about collaboration, is about working with other people, whether about music or film or even like podcasts. You know, like, I'm not on here talking to myself, I'm talking to you. You know, you need to have that collaboration in this. And I think that's another thing, that it's not just like, yeah, one day Johnny Cash woke up and just like wrote a bunch of fucking masterpieces. People work together on this shit.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's so important. And I think it does kind of make the ending a little interesting, because so much of this movie is him working with Iman specifically, but the whole band in certain respect of kind of like building this catalog of songs and these music videos. And it's such a collaboration, like you described. And then what does he do at the end? He runs away with his girlfriend to London with the product of their work, and like they're just left behind, and it's like, huh, I wonder where that goes. But it's an interesting complication to it, where it's like, well, this really was all his idea, and he definitely brought a lot of this out of them, but then he just was okay with leaving them behind without really giving it a second thought, which is the sort of thing that you could only forgive a 16-year-old for doing, you know?
Right. And I do love, it's almost a throwaway line, but when he says to him, he's just like, you know, go to London, get a record deal and bring us back, you know? So I love like a good open-ended ending like this, not where it's just like, what the fuck just happened? Not that kind of ending, but an ending where it's just like, and they went off into the sunset, you know? And it's like, we don't know what happens with him.
It's the perfect moment for the film to end, because the film is so much about that youthful aspiration, that youthful exuberance, that like figuring out who you are and the excitement in that. And whatever happens after they get step off that boat and walk into London, which is, I assume, how it works, right? That you just go over the sea and you just walk right into London. And you're like, I'm from Ireland. Nice to meet you. Would you like to buy my record? Like, whatever happens next, it's going to be one level removed from that feeling of anything is possible, because I believe in myself and because I love what I'm doing and I feel so passionate about all of it. Like, it's all going to be a come down from that, even if then he goes back up and down, you know. But it's you're never going to hit that moment quite the same way again, and that's why it's the perfect moment for this film to end on.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I'm glad that, you know, there's never going to be like a sequel or a revival of this. And that's why, like, I keep bringing it back to Freaks and Geeks. But like, if Freaks and Geeks continues, like if you continue with the story of like Linda Cardellini's character, like what happened after her ending, I think it's less interesting, right? It's more interesting of just like she just went off into the world. Even, you know, one of my favorite books, Winesburg, Ohio, ends with like, it's in a similar way. If anybody's ever read that book, it's one of my favorites. Kind of, it's about this character who lives in this town and kind of is about him getting out. And it's like, do you think he comes back? Do you think he leaves? And it's up for the reader, for the audience to decide. Even, you know, Superbad ends with like these two friends, and they kind of like have this look at each other, and they're both going off to be do with their lives. It's like, yeah, is Seth or is Jonah Hill gonna marry Emma Stone? Like, what's gonna happen? Like, we don't know. It's all left up to us. And that's why it's like, yeah, just him running into the going into the wake, going off into the mist, like leaving to start his new life, presumably. We can imagine whatever we want. It's you know, it's very death of the author, just like whatever we want it to be can be.
Yeah. I will say, I think that, like, especially with the Freaks and Geeks example, but we can extend it to movies as well. I think that if you have really creative people who are passionate about the story that they're telling, the fact that they ended one story perfectly does not mean that they cannot pick up those characters again and tell an incredible story the next time around. And I think that that is something that we've seen, for instance, in a film series like the Before trilogy, Richard Linklater, right?
I was going to say, like, you have a point, because the Before trilogy, like, the first one ends perfectly and ambiguously, but the second one, it's like, that's the best one for me, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And that just goes to show that, like, if you have the talent and you have the passion, that the end of the first installment can be a perfect ending to that story, and then we can pick up those characters later and tell a different story and have a perfect ending for that story as well. I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day about the television series Mad Men, which is a show that me and my friend like absolutely adore. It's one of our favorite things ever that's existed in the planet. And one of the things that I mentioned about that show is that every single season has an incredible season finale. Every single one has a finale where you're like, wow, that is, if it ends here and it and we never pick up these characters again, perfect, no notes, excellent season of television, excellent series. And then you get another season and it deepens the characters, it expands the world, it tells stories that you didn't even know were possible. And it ends and you're like, wow, that is an incredible season finale. No notes. We don't need to pick up again. And then they do it again. And they did it for like 6.5 years, right? So it's possible. And that's the part of the Freaks and Geeks ending that makes me sad, is because I think all those people, they could have come back. They could have made another great season. Could they have made 7 great seasons on network TV? Probably not. But I think they could have gotten like a solid 3-4 seasons of incredible television and that we were robbed of. And that makes me sad. But with this particular movie, I think that I would watch 10 years later what happened to them because it's John Carney doing it, and I would trust him that he could land that plane. But I just it would never change the fact that this is the ending to this story, and it is perfect.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. You know, like, I think of, just because there was a lot of Jurassic Park sequels of varying quality doesn't take anything away from that first one, you know?
No.
So that's a fair point. I still do hope that I don't think that it will be a sequel, but I do like that this is the definitive ending.
Our podcast is the first step on the journey to getting a grassroots movement to Sing Street 2.
Yeah, Sing Street 2 still singing.
Yeah.
But before we completely wrap up, thoughts? Yes, yes.
Did want to say, I found the name of that song that I was referring to earlier. It's Up. That's the soundtrack that I think is just incredibly beautiful, and it's a very sweet song. And yeah, so that's, I would definitely recommend that as well. But it's such a great year for music. Like, I don't know if you guys, 2016 is now a number of years away, but so in addition to Sing Street, we had Moana come out that year, which has an incredible soundtrack that, like, I still play it in my car and it still makes me cry. I don't mind saying that. But then we also have Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping, the Lonely Island movie.
That's what I'm going to cover at some point on this show.
You should, because let me tell you, it is criminally underrated. I watched that movie in a theater with my friend, and then there was 2 other people in the theater with us who we did not know, and that was it. And they were very mad at us by the end of the movie because we just could not stop laughing the entire time, and they were not having as much of fun as we did, but that was on them, not us, because that was incredible. But really funny songs in that. And American Honey is a wonderful film that is not a musical, but has an incredible musical sequence. If anybody has seen American Honey, if you haven't, I strongly recommend. But there's this incredible musical sequence set to We Found Love in a Hopeless Place by Rihanna. That's just I'll never forget. So there's so much like that. Speaking of Jurassic Park, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Swiss Army Man, which is now a much more resonant film now that we have Everything Everywhere All at Once. But I was a big Swiss Army Man fan, and that has this incredible sequence where Daniel Radcliffe and Paul Dano are basically humming the score to Jurassic Park and in this triumphant way. it is completely insane.
Yeah,
And that is still my ringtone, because I loved that moment in that movie so much. So lots of really good musical moments in this year. But Sing Street is just the crowning achievement. It's La La Land is great. It's a wonderful movie. I'm glad that it got a lot of accolades. I'm glad that it was old fashioned movie musical energy with young, cool movie stars. It's something that Hollywood needed. But in my opinion, far and away the best musical movie of 2016 is Sing Street, and it that alone makes it deserve a spot in your podcast of underrated films.
Yeah, absolutely. And just while you're talking, I just quickly checked what the nominees were that year for Best Original Song, and I guess, you know, it's kind of like this year, how people are complaining about Margot Robbie not getting nominated. I'm like, who do you kick off? Because that was a tough cat. Those are some, I don't want to discredit any of these other incredible female performances, you know. And I'm just looking at it, it's you had.
The answer is Annette Bening. No disrespect to Annette Bening, but that is absolutely the answer to that question. It's not that hard for me, but.
I actually didn't see the one she's in. I love Annette Bening, so I probably need to see it.
No one loves Annette Bening more than I do, but that was not an Oscar-nominated worthy film. performance. Jodie Foster in that movie deserved that nomination. She's excellent in it. Part of why she's excellent is because Annette Bening is like going way too big and broad, and Jodie Foster manages to actually make it feel like a coherent person and relationship. So, but that's not what we're here to talk about today.
But yeah, just to like go through this, like it looks like, yeah, like you said, a stacked year for music. You know, you said, you know, like How Far I'll Go from Moana was nominated, and then I don't know what this
incredible
one is, but
song.
It's right. But The Empty Chair from something called Jim, the James Foley story. But I don't know what that is, but it's by Sting. So I love Sting. So and then
we could
got,
probably cut that off the list. I think that's a documentary about a, but I don't recall much about that.
But then you've got Can't Stop the Feeling, which is from the Trolls soundtrack from Justin Timberlake, which like.
Sure.
It's a bop, you know, it's like that movie, like I didn't remember that that was from Trolls, so like I'm like, okay,
well, it's that's an important thing to be nominated, because that is actually how they kicked off the Oscars that year. They opened with Justin Timberlake singing that song and dancing in the audience and getting the crowd going, and everybody's like, that was so fun, what a fun way to start the Oscars. So
right,
that had to happen, I guess.
Yeah, and then the last two, Audition, which is The Fools Who Dream from La La Land, which, like, that song just fucks me up emotionally. And then the one
Absolutely.
That won City of Stars, also from La La Land. So I'm like, that's a tough year. Like, you could make the argument that you could cut the Sting one, maybe, but, like, that's a tough year, I think.
You absolutely could. Like with this year and Best Actress, you could absolutely cut the Sting one and be fine.
But I do love Sting. I that's the thing. It's like I just watched that documentary about him and making The Emperor's New Groove, which I think is a fascinating documentary. If anybody wants to check that out, I think Sting's a really interesting guy. But yeah, so yeah, you know,
yeah, I
maybe
mean,
that's
listen,
the one to cut,
we got a podcast on popreak.com right now all about The Police. Going through their discography, disc by disc, as you would say. So I'm not going to say anything bad about Sting, but I will say he doesn't need the Oscar nomination, especially for a movie that nobody's ever heard of. And the thing that is annoying about Oscar nominations for songs sometimes is that they don't use songs that are incredibly crucial to the film, which is like, why not? Like, if you're nominating a song for a movie awards, it should be a song that means something to the movie, and Drive It Like You Stole It. I mean, it just doesn't get any more meaningful than that. So that I think it has to get in there over Sting. That would be my choice.
Yeah. Yeah. You're probably right. I have to listen to the song, but like, I don't see how that there's so many good
also,
songs.
City of Stars, let's be real, is not the best song. It's just the one that everybody was like, that's the La La Land song. It was in all the trailers. But like, there's like at least two other better songs from La La Land other than City of Stars. Audition, I was happy to see get in there because that's a very good song. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
But City of Stars.
Yeah, that would have been my choice, honestly.
Yeah. And City of Stars is the one that won, which is, if I was picking a song from that list, it would to win, which is not what we're here to do, but we're here, so why not? It would definitely be How Far I Go from Moana, because again, incredibly meaningful to the movie. The entire soundtrack has been building up to it, never mind the arc of the film. And it's just a beautiful song, and it's like empowering, and it's emotional, and it's vulnerable, and it makes me cry whenever it comes on in my car. So I would go with How Far I Go, but Drive It Like I Stole It is a runner-up for sure.
Also, just weird little quirk that I want to point out. That was the last year that Diane Warren wasn't nominated in that category, which is like insane. Like, I remember I have a friend who like I do another podcast with, and he was talking about it. He's like, wow, this Flamin' Hot Cheetos song got nominated. I'm like, yeah, it's Diane Warren. She always gets nominated. So like, that was such a strong
absolutely
year that not even she could make it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, we got to do something about this Diane Warren situation. It is. We need to have that conversation, as Kamala Harris likes to say.
She also got nominated the 2 years before that. So, like, that's how good a year is that the Academy shut her out the one time in, the past decade plus, you know?
You're like, Diane, sit down. It's Sting's turn for some reason.
But, yeah, man, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. I got one more question for you, and it's not necessarily related to this movie, but I wanted to ask you, you know, we talked a lot about how this is, you know, a really great coming of age movie. Do you have a particular coming of age movie that really you wanted to mention or stands out to you, one or two, or just anything you want to mention?
Oh man, that's tough. That's really hard to just drop on me without any notice.
Yeah, sorry.
First answer, best answer, Lady Bird by Greta Gerwig from 1 year after this, 2017, I think is an incredible coming of age story. You get a full year of this girl's high school life. You get the life, the loves, the triumphs, the tribulations, the best friends, parent issues, and all of it. It's there. Saoirse Ronan gives an incredible performance, and I think that that would probably be my pick off the top of my head. But I could probably, if you gave me a day, come up with a list of 50 great coming of age movies that I absolutely love. But off the top of my head, it's going to be Lady Bird.
I like to spring something on, I guess, every episode. So that's, I had to keep you on your feet. But yeah,
Call Me By Your Name counts as a coming of age story, which it is very much a coming of age story, but also a love story. That would also be in contention. I love Call Me By Your Name. It's one of my all time favorite films. So that would be up there also from 2017, an incredible year, the year 2017. So that would be up there as well. But I think just pure category of, if we're just being really specific about the category of coming of age film, I would say Lady Bird.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, so this is kind of, you know, I'll admit this on the pod. Those are both movies that I've been really wanting to watch for a while, and I haven't gotten around to yet. And I really need, Lady Bird is, like, very high. And I've actually never seen a Luca Guadagnino movie. I'm very excited for Challengers because I'm a big tennis fan. And also, that movie has, like, three things that I'm, like, very excited for, which is tennis, Zendaya, and, like, a love triangle. I'm like, yes, yes, yes. Uh-huh. So I'm going to definitely correct that blind spot. But, yeah, I'm going to definitely try and see both of those soon.
Luca is an incredible artist who I love deeply. His films are not for everyone. I will warn you on that front, but I think Call Me By Your Name is probably his most accessible film. So definitely that would be a good place to start.
Okay. All right. They're both on my like Letterboxd watch list, but so are like 500 other 550 other movies, you know? So hopefully I'll be able to get to him soon. And then, yeah, I guess I'll just answer as well. You know, I brought it up a couple times. It's one that I think gets short shrift sometimes because it is pretty crass. It is, you know, it's that Judd Apatow thing that was kind of looked down at the time. But I think that in terms of just being very true to, and the reason it's crass is because it feels very real to how, especially like teenagers talked in 2007, high schoolers talked, because I was also a senior in high school when it came out, which was super bad. Yeah. Like that's a movie I think it's so, like, I'm like, yeah, this is just how me and my friends who were idiots at the time, because we're in high school, we're dumb. Like, that's how we talked, that's how we acted. And some of the situations with the cops and stuff might be a little exaggerated, but the characters, especially the high schoolers, never feel unreal. They always feel like, wow, this is, you just filmed my life, you know?
Yeah, Superbad also came out when I was a senior in high school, so that was a very important film for me and my friends. It was very much a like, oh, wow, they're making movies about us now. Look at that. It's the kid from Arrested Development. How exciting, you know? So I definitely feel you on that one. That would definitely be in the list for sure. As would another film from 2016 called The Edge of 17, which is a great Haley Steinfeld film from 2016 that I think would be a good film to talk about on your podcast, because it is definitely underrated and it is really, really excellent.
Yeah, that honestly, I might have to add that to the like potential episodes list, because that was really, really great.
I remember seeing it in theaters and then walking out and texting my friend who loves coming of age stories and like literally not even getting to my car being like, I have to text you immediately to tell you that you will love this movie if you see it. And he did see it and he did love it, but almost no one else saw it. And that sucks.
Yeah, that's perfect. And then before we completely end, there's one more thing I just realized too while we were talking about coming of age movies and Superbad and how like it makes sense that that's so tight. It feels like Freaks and Geeks because Seth Rogen wrote it on the set of Freaks and Geeks while he was supposed to be doing homework, but he was just writing Superbad instead. So I just gotta throw that little connective piece of tissue in too. But yeah, man, this was a ton of fun. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about this one with me. Where can people find you and find your podcasts?
Yeah, so you could follow me on Letterboxd at Media Thinkings, where I have a list of my favorite films from 2016. I have a list of my favorite films of John Carney, and I have a list of many other things because I love lists. So you can follow me over there for that. You can follow me on Blue Sky at Alex Marcus. As I said, go to thepopbreak.com, click on the podcast tab. You can see all the podcasts that we're doing. Lots of really great stuff. Like I said, reality TV, regular TV, movies, music, wrestling, you name it. We got some coverage of it. So definitely go on, check that out. But in particular, Bill versus the MCU podcast that is very special to me, and we are doing X-Men. We did last month, we did the original 2000s era X-Men franchise trilogy. That's X-Men or X2 and then X-Men The Last Stand, and that was a fun one to record because we were like, wow, it was so great to get to rewatch these movies. Oh, and then we just had a meltdown at the end of it to talk about the third one. So that was fun. Next month we're going to be doing the First Class trilogy, and yes, there is a fourth one, but we have a special episode planned for the fourth one. So next month it's just going to be First Class, Days of Future Past, and Apocalypse. And it's really a blast to go through all of these movies, because you know we've spent so much time in the Marvel universe where things are so carefully constructed, and there's really a lot of thought about like how can we bring the comic book world into cinema in a way that is accessible to audiences. And Fox, well, they just had a very different process in terms of how they treated their material, and it's really fun to dive into that.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. I cannot wait to listen to those episodes because, like, as you said, you know, Fox was just gonna like do it whatever, like don't worry about continuity. Did you see the last one? Cool. You'll probably get what's going on with this one. Like, whatever, you know. So, good stuff. Good stuff. And yeah, definitely everyone go and check that out. After you're done checking that out, you know, if you guys want to check out the other show that I do, I kind of brought it up for a second earlier, check out the Midnight Film Society. It comes out on the opposite Monday that this one comes out. So, me and my friend Damien talk about more recent released movies or kind of more current things like the Oscars or whatever might be going on. So check that out. Follow us everywhere at Underrated Film Podcast. So, you know, Instagram, Facebook, all the places. If you're not already following the show, we would love you to do that. And if you can rate us 5 stars, that helps the show so much. We also have the Patreon, where I do 2 bonus podcasts, Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones, which you've been so kind enough to have been on in the past, is moving over there now, as well as my sports film show, Underdogs. And this month we'll have covered a boxing film. I don't know yet because I'm in the past here recording this, but you will know because it'll already be out. And then I just also wanted to mention sometimes I like to read a review if somebody leaves like a nice review for Underrated. This one's from a couple months back, but felt like might as well read it because I was really touched by it. Somebody wrote, TCray808 wrote the title, "Must listen for any cinema fan. Such a great podcast. You can tell that the hosts are so knowledgeable and passionate about the film. Derek is a fantastic and great host." So when I read that, it really meant quite a bit to me. You know, when you guys do write reviews, when you do rate the show, I do see it. It means a ton to me. And when you write something as kind as that, it really means a lot. So I just wanted to make sure that, you know, the love you're giving me, I'm putting back out to you guys. So yeah, with that, one more time, Alex, I want to say thank you so much for coming on. And I would love to have you back sometime. This was a great one. I'll catch you later, man.
Yeah, thank you so much. As I said, this has been an absolute pleasure. I will be back here anytime you ask.
All right, excellent. All right, see you guys all later.